Sure.
This is Mandy.
And this is Leanne.
And you're listening to Two Blonde Sleuths. It's episode 20.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we made it to 20. So today I have a mystery case to tell you, Leanne.
Okay.
Actually, I have two separate mystery cases.
A double feature.
Yes. And they're only similar because they're older cases, and both to this day remain a mystery. Mm-hmm. So first, I'm going to tell you about the escape from Alcatraz. Alcatraz Prison was supposed to be the ultimate maximum security prison. Located on a lonely island in the middle of San Francisco Bay, Alcatraz, a.k.a. The Rock, had held prisoners since the Civil War.
Right.
Some of the inmates held there were Al Capone, George Machine Gun Kelly. Have you heard of him? I've only from that singer.
Yeah.
That's not his real name.
But yeah.
criminals who had a history of escaping, they sent them there.
Okay.
So in the 1930s, they did a redesign of the place to make it really secure. So it was already surrounded by cold, rough waters of the Pacific, but the redesign included tougher iron bars, more positioned guard towers and stricter rules, and dozens checks a day of the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Escape seemed nearly impossible, even with all the new things in place. From 1934 until the prison was closed in 1963, 36 men tried 14 separate escapes.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all were caught or did not survive the attempt. That was until three inmates escaped in 1962. To this day, no one knows if they made it to shore or if they died in the cold waters. All right, I'm going to tell you how this happened.
Okay.
Frank Morris came to Alcatraz in January 1960. He was convicted of bank robbery, burglary, and some other crimes. He was a repeated... Yeah, he was probably... He was a repeated offender on trying to escape as well. So they said, we're sending you to the Rock, buddy. later that year, a convict...
No.
Yeah, right? A convict by the name John... Anglin, A-N-G-L-I-N.
Uh-huh.
Okay. He was sent to the prison, and not long after he got there, his brother Clarence Anglin arrived at Alcatraz. All three men had known each other from previous stints in prisons. They asked for adjoining cells, and it got granted. So I guess it wasn't.
Which I think is really crazy, but okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so they all were side by side. I had read many places that there was a fourth man in the prison that was supposed to escape
mm-hmm.
with the men. So there was four cells in a row. More on that later. But Morris was, he was thought to be the brains of the guys, and he hatched the plan. It would take almost a year for all of this to come together. Alan West, he was the fourth inmate that did not get to escape. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was, we'll get back to him later, but yes, he did not escape. So it was just the three guys. So on June 12, 1962, the routine morning bed check turned out three inmates were not in their cells.
Mm-hmm.
John Anglin, his brother Clarence, and Frank Morris in their beds were very well-crafted human, like, dummy heads.
Dummy.
Yes. They had real hair on them.
Mm-hmm.
They had real hair as on for hair on the head, eyebrows, and eyelashes. And they were painted, like, with a paper mache. I'll post a picture of
them. For this crafty
they
class.
They were pretty crafty. One of... The guys, he had worked in the barbershop.
Yeah.
And so they said that's how they got the real hair. So it definitely fooled the night guards.
Like, not just the typical shoving a pillow under the
blanket. No, this is like a well-crafted real hair on the head.
Yeah.
On the paper mache head. And this, it fooled the night guards. So that gave the prisoners a 10-hour head start, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
When the morning... guard came in, he noticed when they didn't move or didn't wake up that those were the fake heads were in there. So the prison immediately went into lockdown and the intense search began.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI was notified immediately and asked to help. By the way, most of the research came from the official FBI website, mm-hmm. which I did not know they had one out.
And I'm pretty excited about.
Yeah, when I was researching the case, I was like, okay, maybe we'll get our facts, some of the facts straight and not mess up. Like
and we not have, get in trouble.
Not get in trouble by...
people,
not naming detectives,
you know this,
and not naming any names, but we just want to try to.
We are just amateur sleuths.
We are amateur podcasters.
We're not journalists.
No, really you're not.
Trying to get a Pulitzer.
No, we're just telling stories, and you know, in our own way. So sorry if we don't get everything correct, but hopefully we'll try very hard. And so the FBI website, I thought was pretty good.
Yeah.
Place to find it. So it took 2 days for anything to be found. A packet of letters from one of the inmates and some paddle-like pieces of wood and bits of rubber inner tube were found in the water. Okay, that took a couple days. A homemade life vest was also discovered washed up on the beach nearby. As days went on, the FBI Coast Guard and prison authorities were able to put together how the inmates escaped. You want to know how they did it?
Yes, I did.
So, with the help of Alan West, the guy that hit, didn't make it out, Alan. This group had started the plan the previous December when one of the guys came across an old saw blade. Using some homemade tools, a drill made from a motor of a broken vacuum. Pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
They each loosened their air vents. They had, you know, air vents on their cells. So they loosened them with the drill.
Mm-hmm.
So they would just put holes and holes all around the wall, like all on the wall around the air vent, just to make the air vent hole bigger. And then they could put the cover back on it, or they could put, when it got too big, I guess, they put things in front of it, like apparently they had guitars and
this is a good time in Alcatraz.
Yeah, no, I guess they were
crafting, like, getting your hair done.
Yes.
Playing music.
Yes, playing with paper mache and saws. Yeah. And they were making these holes in the air vent big enough for them to fit through. And behind their cell walls was a utility room where they kept all their tools and it was their workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So they could keep, you know, the homemade tools that they made and things they used to make the holes bigger. They made a raft and life preservers from 50 raincoats that they had collected from the prison. And so nobody noticed 50 rain jackets were gone.
Where were they stored it? In their storage?
In the storage room that was behind their cell.
But nobody was in the craft room, like a guard that said...
Well, because they stitched them together with a sewing machine.
But the sewing machine had to be in a craft room or in their cell. Sewing all day on these rain.
Yeah, unless they took the sewing machine up to a workshop.
I don't know. I just feel like somebody would have seen.
I know.
Maybe that's off.
No, not only did they sew it together, because obviously that's not going to just seal in the water.
But they probably took it for granted since they were covered.
Well, because they were covered in
surrounded
water.
Surrounded by water. They probably thought, man, they're all. What are they going to do?
Unescapable.
Yeah.
I know. They didn't think.
Yeah.
So they also sealed the rubber together by hot steam pipes. That this idea came from a magazine found in one of their cells. I thought that was pretty clever.
Green magazine.
They had music time too, because they had instruments. They built wooden paddles and converted a musical instrument into a tool to inflate the raft, like to blow it up. So I thought that was pretty cool. The ceiling that was about 30 feet high of the prison.
I'm wondering how Frank even ever got caught in the first place if he knows how to do all that.
I know. Who got caught? Frank? Are you talking about?
Like, how did he get caught?
Being a bank robber and everything like that?
He's clever. Right?
Yeah. I know. He's pretty clever. So they climbed up. Since it had a 30-foot ceiling, they climbed up using a network of pipes. So they pried open the ventilator at the top of the shaft, and they kept it in place temporarily by a fake bolt they made from soap. So that was pretty smart, too. Yeah. On June 11th, they were ready to go. West did not have his ventilator completely done, so he was left behind.
Again with poor West.
Yeah.
He was busy working on everybody else's crap and couldn't get his shit together.
He was probably busy sewing that 50 life jackets together and like, then sealing them with the hot pipe.
I can't get my stuff together. And they just left him like,
They were like, you know what? This is the night. So
can't keep up, West.
I know. That night, the three others climbed through their vents, went to the utility room, got their gear, climbed up, and out through the vent of the prison roof. Then they
sewed them together.
Yeah. And they blew them up. Then they shimmy down the bakery smokestack at the rear of the cell house, climbed over the fence, stuck into the north shore of the island, and launched their raft. The mystery remains to this day. Did they make it to shore, or did they get swept away by the wind and the waves?
I kind of like that they got away.
I definitely think they got away, because I never found any bodies. So after 17 years, the FBI closed the case on December 31st, 1979. They said they turned over the responsibilities to the U.S. Marshals. And they just said, you know what? This is, if any other, they think that they perished. That's what they said anyway. The only clues, there has been like supposed sightings of the brothers in Brazil. There was a picture taken of these two guys in Brazil. That
what about the third one? Anybody? You worry on him? The third?
No, the mother, I mean, not pictures or anything, but the mother got Christmas cards for 3 years after they escaped that was signed by both of the brothers that had no postage.
Maybe two made it and one didn't.
Yeah, maybe, but they never found his body either. Yeah. But I guess one body is easier to not find than three.
Yeah.
The History Channel has a special where they are working with the family, the nephews of the guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're working with them trying to figure out if that, you know, if this picture's with them or.
Yeah.
They said, like, the mother also got, along with the card, she got a rose, you know, she'd get a rose sent to her, just random things. But they had looked into if the family helped them, but they said the family just wasn't financially, they don't think they were, like, financially able to have helped them.
Yeah, I mean, they literally left Alcatraz with nothing. So I'm wondering how they even.
Yeah.
And I guess back then, was it like it is now? Like, you could get a job and not have to.
No, there wasn't the internet.
Verified.
They didn't even have social security numbers back then. I remember I got one in the early 90s.
So you had one?
No, I did not get one until I was in the 80s. I was way after I was born. I remember my dad getting us a social security number in the 80s. It was probably late 80s. Yeah, we did not have one. I remember when I got mine. So we did not have to have
one. I mean, just your card.
Well, no, I had issued my number then. Yeah. For sure. We'll Google it. The history I read somewhere where a letter was written in 2013 to the San Francisco police, one of the brothers saying that he said he wrote his name and said they escaped from Alcatraz that night in June 1962. And he said, we all made it, but barely. He claimed they all lived to an old age. Clarence, his brother, had died in 2008 and Morris had died in 2005. He asked, he said he was an old man that had cancer. He was 83 and that he needed medical treatment. And he asked if he turned himself in for that medical care. Could they announce on TV or would they, before he turned himself in, announce on TV and that to make him only serve 1 year?
Wait, which one was this?
That was, so Clarence's brother.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was one of the brothers, not the third guy. Nobody's ever heard about the third guy.
No, and he said that Morris died in 2005. He said that in the letter. But
So he said that he survived.
Yeah, this is what he's saying. So this is what the letter said. But the San Francisco Police Department, they didn't make this letter public till 5 years after they received it. I think they wanted to investigate it and things like that. And the family was pretty upset of the guys because they were like, well, what if it was him and he had cancer and he was dying and we could have seen him before that. But they did handwriting analysis on it and deemed it inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know.
I guess it'd be hard to know. And I mean, as bad as it sounds, I mean, I guess somebody could have been messing with the brother's mom sending.
Yeah, you know, for sure. They could have.
Hopefully not.
I think they just wanted to act like the, you know, FBI is like, we just never found any evidence. So there was just nothing they could do.
Yeah.
And you're right. It was easier to disappear back then.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have definitely gotten away with it. Yeah. And I saw recently where they did a composite sketch of what they look like now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, they're like 90-something-year-old men. And I'm like, that's kind of crazy. They really think they're all alive, I guess. Because why would they go through the trouble of doing the composite sketch? Somebody thinks they're alive.
Yeah. But in their 90s, really?
I know. I mean, most people don't.
I guess you can, but that's not.
You definitely can.
It's not the norm.
No, but I guess they might look similar than they would have in their 70s. And they're thinking, you know, is this somebody?
I mean, their handwriting would never be different now than it was when they were,
for sure,
in prison because they'd be, you know.
So the handwriting analysis probably wouldn't have made a difference.
No, I don't think so.
All right. So I'm going to tell you my second story. Are you ready for the second story?
I'm ready.
Okay. This next story I'm going to tell you happened a little over 50 years ago.
Okay.
It's the mystery of D.B. Cooper.
Yes.
You know this mystery, I assume. Where did you hear about this mystery?
I've seen a couple of shows on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then just over time, I guess I've heard. And then also it's in a Kid Rock song.
I don't know.
Who's D.B. Cooper and how much money did he take?
Well, he took $200,000, which would be equivalent to $1.4 million today. But I actually saw it. I saw that when I was researching this, the Netflix is about to put out a 4-part series on it, which I had no idea. So I was like, that'd be cool because I don't really get into at the end of the story. I don't really, there's so many suspects that they think it could be. And I don't really get into it because it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they get into it in the Netflix series. But since this was a 2-parter tonight and there were so many and none of them have actually been, you know, deemed to be the guy the day before Thanksgiving in 1971, a guy calling himself Dan Cooper bought a one-way ticket for $20. The media actually mistakenly
so much.
The media mistakenly called him D.B. Cooper for some reason. So that's where he got the name D.B. Cooper. But it was Dan Cooper written on the boarding pass.
Was his middle initial? Did it start with a B?
No. Okay. There's a reason why, and I read a couple different things. So I'm not sure. But he boarded Northwest Airlines Flight 305 in Portland, bound for Seattle. The plane had 36 passengers, not including the crew. He was wearing a dark suit, a black tie, and was described as being in business attire.
Mm-hmm.
So when in the air, he orders a drink and passes a note to the flight attendant, which she did not read because supposedly back then, especially, men would give flight attendants their phone number on a piece of paper or their room number.
It's probably still like that now.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah.
And she probably was just like, yeah, okay, here we go, another one.
Thanks, fella.
Took it in my pocket. So he asked her, he was like, come over here, you better read that note. You know, he like kind of got her to sit next to him, and he opened his briefcase and showed her he had a bomb in the briefcase. Mm-hmm. And he tells her, I'm taking over this plane, and these are my demands. And he had written them on a piece of paper. And he said, if they're not met, I'm going to blow up the plane. So he told her to take this to the pilot, which she did. And the note said he wanted $200,000 in cash, and all in 20s, by the way, two parachutes and two backup parachutes, and no funny business is what the note said on it. So, of course, she took it right away. The crew contacted air traffic control. They contacted the police, and someone contacted the airline president, who said comply with the demands because he didn't want the bad publicity. He didn't want, all that out there about his airline company. And so they did it. And so he wanted these things when they landed in Seattle. And, this wasn't a very long flight. So they had to circle for 2 hours. They had to circle the plane until everything was there.
Yeah.
And they told him it was time, that they could land. He let all the passengers get off the plane except for 4 crew members. And those were to help him fly out again.
Right.
So he didn't kill anybody. He didn't seem like too bad of a guy.
He's like a nice guy. He just wants money.
He threatened a bomb. I mean, but that's it.
But was it even real?
I don't know. I guess we'll never know. But most of the passengers were even unaware of the hijacking, so it must not have been too bad. I don't know how you didn't notice your flight was 2 hours longer, but maybe they were taking
naps. Or you were flying in circles.
Yeah, or that you were flying in circles.
Unless maybe the pilot was saying, waiting for, to be clear to land or something. Maybe he made up something to keep them.
Yeah, maybe he said something like that. Yeah. They figured the 4 parachutes meant that he was taken a hostage.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought about using dummy parachutes, but they didn't want a chance, risking a civilian's life or anything. So they didn't. They gave him real ones. And he wanted military grade, which is
kind of the difference in a regular one and a military
grade. I don't know, but they thought he possibly was in the military. So he wanted them to fly him to Mexico City, but that wouldn't work because they would need more fuel. He did get them to refuel in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So they agreed that they would stop in Reno, Nevada to refill again.
Mm-hmm.
So once back in the air, he got the flight attendant to read him the instructions on lowering the stairs on the plane. And she told him, she said, I don't think that this will open mid-flight. And he told her she was wrong. He seemed to know a lot about this type of plane and even skydiving. He instructed the pilot to remain below 10,000 feet and keep the airspeed below 150 knots. He told the captain to depressurize the cabin. He knew that you could breathe at only 10,000 feet. And, when I assumed that when he opened the stairs, he would not want a violent gust of wind coming in.
To get sucked out.
Yeah. So he told the flight attendant to go into the cabin with the rest of the crew. So after they went over everything, I guess he was getting ready to go. They said they don't know exactly when he jumped, but the red light came on about 30 minutes later. And they think that that's when he opened the stairs because it was a notification that said the stairs was open.
Yeah.
So they were 25 miles north of Portland near the Lewis River. They landed in Reno safe. Just the plane had a little bit of damage from the stairs being open when they landed. And Cooper was never seen again. The bad weather made it where they couldn't even search for him until the next day. So he also had
a head start. Yeah.
Yeah. There's been so many people that they have looked into over the years because they had a composite sketch and he had his sunglasses on. I think he
have kind of like long hair?
No.
I don't know why. I feel like I remember that.
But he had glasses on. I mean, he did look, and he was a well-dressed man.
Yeah.
I mean, none of them have ever been proven for sure that they're D.B. Cooper, but the only concrete evidence they ever had was on February 10th, 1980, an 8-year-old boy found bundles of $20 bills. And they thought, okay, that's strange. They went and looked, and the serial numbers did match the money that Cooper was given. So they knew that this money came from him, and that made them think Cooper didn't survive. But they did, there was like a rubber band still around the money, and they said that rubber band would not have withheld the elements. Mm-hmm. And they said if it was buried, then it could have. So I think he buried the money, and somehow, you know, he forgot.
Or Bart couldn't carry it on.
Yeah,
buried. Maybe he just went somewhere, and he didn't need to come back.
Yeah, and that was in February. So unfortunately, an eruption of Mount St. Helens on May 18th, 1980, could have destroyed any more evidence. Now that they had kind of a where point of where they think that he had landed,
yeah,
you know, that maybe more could have been found, but destroyed that chance. So the FBI announced in 2016 they would no longer be actively looking at leads. They said it was most likely in that weather in the Washington wilderness, in business attire clothing, he was unlikely to have survived.
I like to think he survived.
I think he buried the money, part of it,
yeah,
and just forgot where he buried it, and, you know, maybe went back. And I mean, there's so many people that were like, on my grandfather's deathbed, he said he was D.B. Cooper. I mean, yeah. It can't be everybody. It was only one person. So did they ever find the guy? I don't know. But you could definitely go over and read about the list of suspects
because yeah. There's
so many. And it is very interesting. I mean, nobody's been officially, a lot of them they thought was him, and then they looked into where he was that day, and I mean, he wasn't anywhere near there.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And so I definitely think he survived. Because they didn't even find the out of the parachutes. I think he left the other parachute on there. So he just took the one.
Oh,
he
okay.
left the other parachute because he only needed one, which I think he's really smart to ask for two, because that made them, because obviously, I mean, he wouldn't know that it was faulty until he got out to jump.
Yeah.
And then they definitely could have found him and gotten the $200,000 back. So I guess we'll never know.
I guess we'll never know.
Those mysteries still remain.
I'm pretty excited about the Netflix special though.
I know. I'm sure it'll have lots of details.
Yeah.
And being a 4-part series, I'm sure they'll go over all the suspects that they think it was. They think he was a disgruntled employee of the airline. They think he was, you know, something happened with the military.
He just seems like he was a very cool person.
Yeah.
Like to just walk onto a plane.
Yeah.
You know,
and his luggage like probably fell off flight.
Yeah.
You know,
this is mid-jump. What's about to happen right now.
And then
he was real nice to everybody, real calm, real cool.
They said he had a bourbon and he smoked 8 cigarettes. And, you know, if they still had those cigarettes, they could do DNA on them. But
yeah.
They've disappeared or they don't have them. Or
most people who are about to hijack her hijacking a plane are not that cool about it.
Yeah.
So he had to be kind of a cool guy. Or maybe he wasn't a cool guy and he just was playing a part.
But he forgot to, like, wear boots that day or ask for boots and a size, whatever. But he had a clip-on tie, and they said the tie was left behind.
He didn't want to lose it.
And I think he didn't want to lose his tie.
Gary Cooper doesn't need boots. He can wear loafers.
Yeah, he can. I mean, the parachutes and loafers, though. That might be the one thing you didn't think about.
If you're D.B. Cooper.
If you're D.B. Cooper, you can do
parachute and loafers. Into the wilderness.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening.
And don't forget to go on and rate and review us on
Apple Podcasts,
Amazon.
Spotify. And also email us at twoblondsleuths@gmail.com as long as it's nice.
Yeah.
And sorry if we get things wrong.
We're not perfect.
And thanks for listening.